This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Inflation, crypto, and EVs. Not in that order, though, I think. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 9th day of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with the fairly fundamental, but perhaps not said out loud often enough idea that money has a price, and that price is set in most modern economies by central banks. Interest rates, right? The price you got to pay to borrow the money you want. And as we know, the price of money is going up. It's going up here, thank you, Federal Reserve, and also in Europe. The European Central Bank announced this morning it's going to start raising its key interest rate next month, while at the same time, and stop me if you've heard this one before, while at the same time putting an end to its big bond buying program. Again, thank you, Federal Reserve. Marketplace's Lily Jamali is on the Inflation is Global desk today.
If you thought inflation was bad here, it's even worse in Europe. Take natural gas, which following Russia's invasion of Ukraine now costs almost three times as much in Europe as it does in the U.S. Wharton's Philip Nichols says that's a big problem for the European Central Bank.
There's no question their task is more complicated than the Fed's in the United States.
The Europeans are trying to get inflation under control while also trying to wean themselves off of Russian energy, a big driver of higher prices, says Steve Sakala, who teaches economics at Tufts.
The energy situation in Europe right now is tenuous, and I think looking forward to the winter that they're going to have to get through, even more tenuous. They are ultimately facing a supply crunch.
And there's not a whole lot that monetary policymakers can do about low supply.
All central banks can do is manage demand.
Megan Green is chief economist at Kroll.
Central banks can't really do anything about gas prices. They can't really do anything about energy costs.
The fix for inflation may end up causing economic pain of a different kind, says ING's Karsten Brzeski.
I think we're currently running the risk that we will see the ECB hiking interest rates while the Eurozone economy goes into recession.
One that could be made far worse by any further shocks to Europe's energy supplies. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
The root cause of all the central bank agita here and everywhere is, of course, inflation. An update on which we will get tomorrow morning with the May Consumer Price Index. 8.3% was the April reading, if perchance you'd forgotten. Which is honestly a stupid thing to say because, of course, nobody has forgotten. Case in point, the Washington Post and George Mason University were out with a poll today which found 66% of Americans expect inflation to get worse over the next year. So today from us, something a little bit different. What you want to know about inflation and our answers. We went out to two places, Tampa, Florida, where regional inflation was 10.2% for the year ending in March, well above the national rate, right? Also Detroit, where prices were up 8.3% for the year ending April, just about on the national number. So here we go.
Hi, I'm Anaya Hampton, and I'm from Tampa.
Winona Foster, and I'm from Tampa as well.
We caught up with them outside Tanya and Matt's ice creamiest shop. It's in North Tampa. And their joint inflation question goes like this.
Why is it going on? Like, what's the actual real reason for this going on, you know?
Same. Like, what's going on in the world that's making this happen?
So the super quick answer, because this is only a half hour program, and honestly, it's a PhD thesis to answer that question. But a little bit more than 2 years ago, we shut the economy down, right? The global economy closed. We just turned it off. And now, with pent-up consumer demand and supply chains that haven't been able to adjust, and a war in Ukraine driving fuel and food costs up, and yes, maybe government spending, fiscal stimulus, right? Maybe that's a factor, too. You roll all that together, and inflation is kind of the textbook result. That's what happens when supply and demand get out of whack. Couple of more what is going on with inflation questions coming up. Wall Street on this Thursday. This was an inflation is a bad thing day. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Biden administration has a goal as part of its climate plan. By 2030, so 7.5 years from now, give or take, half of all the new cars sold in this economy will be electric or electric hybrid. And as part of that, the White House is spending $7.5 billion to get 500,000 new EV chargers up and running. Today, the administration proposed new rules that would, among a bunch of other things, require that charging stations built with federal money be able to accommodate any electric car, which, as EV owners will happily tell you, just ain't the case today. Marketplace's Samantha Fields is on it.
Imagine you're out driving and you need gas. So you pull into a gas station, only to find the pumps don't fit your car. Or maybe a couple do, but they have long lines. That's kind of the deal now with electric vehicles. There's no standard charger.
That's a situation that we would like to move away from.
Jessica Trancic at MIT says the new rules would mean all new charging stations built with federal funding would have to be universal.
It is really important to know that when you're driving up to a charger, that you're going to be able to use it, obviously, and also that chargers are going to be available at regular intervals along your trip.
Having a lot more chargers that any EV can use is going to be key to getting more people to go electric, says Michelle Krebs at Cox Automotive.
There's three things that stand in the way of massive EV adoption: price, range, and the charging infrastructure.
That infrastructure has improved a lot, but Jeremy Mihalik at Carnegie Mellon University says there are still real barriers, especially for anyone who doesn't have a driveway. That was him when he first got an electric car.
And I could not count on being able to charge it every day. It depended if I got the spot in front of my house or not. And I had to run an extension cord up the stairs to plug it in.
Kind of a hard sell.
If you don't have off-street parking, you need to know that you are going to have access to public chargers and be able to reliably charge your vehicle.
Both near your house and along the highway. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
This being Thursday, as it is, we got our weekly update on first-time claims for unemployment benefits this morning. 229,000 people lost their jobs last week. That's up a bit, but still well in line with where that number was back in the before times. So we're going to use that as a way to talk about this. People who had pandemic-related jobs, but now largely don't. I read a story the other day by Shabelle Carazana. She covers the economy at the 19th. Pointing out that the early data shows women of color made up most of the COVID workforce, testing centers and the like, and that now, with the pandemic, if not winding down, but certainly less, you know, attention getting than it used to be, and testing sites getting shut down, what happens to that labor force?
A lot of these folks came in to serve an enormous need during a time when, you know, they were coming into these jobs. They were typically higher paid jobs. They were jobs that they could come into with little experience in public health. And now what we're seeing with places winding down and also these contracts that came in through the federal government to make these jobs available are now also ending. And they're trying to see what happens next.
We should be explicit here, right? This COVID-19 testing workforce was overwhelmingly women. It was overwhelmingly women of color. It was, as you said, higher paid jobs that, being honest, it's unlikely that they will be able to replicate in a non-COVID testing situation. What happens to them?
That's exactly right, right? So we were seeing people earning $30 an hour or more in many cases through these positions. A lot of women of color also lost their jobs during the pandemic. Also, to begin with, public health is a field that already employs majority women. And you have these folks coming in who are trusted leaders in their community, trusted messengers, have a sense of responsibility, and were really effective in this work.
Can we dig into that trusted messenger thing for a minute? Because you have women of color doing the testing and the monitoring and a lot of the public health work in a pandemic in which people of color overwhelmingly suffered. And there's some connection there, and I can't quite put my finger on it, but that seems to matter.
Absolutely. I mean, to that point of sort of a sense of responsibility, that's something that really came up when I was talking to workers in this workforce who had personal experiences with loss during COVID and felt like they could be the ones to, you know, convince someone to get a vaccine or help people get tested or contact trace. And they were doing it out of that sense of responsibility. But we saw it across the country when the first person got vaccinated in every state, right? In almost every single state, the first person to be vaccinated was a woman of color, typically a nurse. And
yeah, healthcare worker,
they did
sure.
it. Yeah, yeah, yeah. They did it. They did it to help their own community, you know, have some trust.
Right. And they did it publicly. I'm sure you spoke to dozens of women for this story. Pick your favorite. Tell me a good story.
Let me think. Well, one of my favorite stories was a woman in Texas who was an immigrant, grew up low wage with her, raised by her mother and her grandmother. Her mother was a nurse, and she went and started doing this work as well, working in clinics, trying to get folks vaccinated. And her responsibility was to find areas in Houston where folks were not getting access to the vaccine. She tells the story of an Afghan family that she spoke to in an apartment complex in Houston that was all refugees. And they welcomed her into their apartment late at night, 8 people to a 600 square foot apartment. All of them got vaccinated that night, made her a meal, were so thankful, but simply did not have the connections, the understanding to go seek out sort of this healthcare themselves until she came to their door. And for her, this was a moment where she said, you know, this is really why we did this work, for these small success stories. And so now she is looking at a career working in a shelter with immigrant children, similar to her own background. And she says, you know, as a woman of color, that is what helped open doors for me when so many were shut, because they trusted me to talk to them directly from personal experience. And that's how we got people vaccinated.
Shibeli Karazana is the economy reporter at The 19th. Shibeli, thanks a lot. I really appreciate your time and your reporting.
Thank you so much.
Here's another inflation question, the most commonly asked one in point of fact. Got this one from people in Tampa and Detroit both.
My name is Musa, Musa Kasim.
Andrea Barcelo.
Robert Del Freo.
So I was wondering, when do you think everything go back to normal?
How long is it going to take to fix it?
How long is the inflation going to take? I mean, when is it going to stop? Actually, that's, I think, everybody's question.
The most commonly asked, also the most easily answered, nobody knows. Not Jay Powell, not Janet Yellen, definitely not me. It's all about when that supply-demand thing gets figured out. Coming up.
I don't Snapchat, I don't TikTok, I don't whatever those other things are.
Yeah, no, you and me both, pal. You and me both. First, though, let's do the numbers. All right. Yeah, I'll give you the wah-wahs. Dow Industrial's down 638 points today, 1.9%. 32,272. The NASDAQ off 332 points, 2.75%, closed at 11,754. S&P 500 down 97, just shy of 2.4%, 4,017. Smith Fields was telling us about EV chargers. Well, here you go. Electric vehicle maker Tesla dimmed almost 0.9% today despite an upgrade from UBS, which said the company was best positioned to become one of the top three global car makers by 2030. I personally think that's a stretch. They don't make near as many cars as, oh, say, Ford Motor does, which dipped 1.8% today. Bond prices down. Yield on the 10-year T-note, 3.04%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You know, online shopping is kind of an amazing thing, right? A couple of clicks, whatever you want shows up on your doorstep a couple of days later. We all know that. And if you don't like it, or it's the wrong size, or even if you just change your mind, you can send it back for free. Or at least you used to be able to. Zara has started charging people to return online purchases over in the UK, unless said returns are made in person, which kind of defeats the point, right? And honestly, return shipping and restocking fees are kind of becoming a thing. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has that one.
For retailers, returns are a pain. Kathy Robertson at the Reverse Logistics Association says warehouses have whole departments where people plug in toasters to make sure they work or give sneakers the sniff test.
And if they smell like feet, they're not going to go back into a store to be resold.
Not a glamorous job, but someone's got to do it because returns are surging. Americans sent back $760 billion worth of stuff last year. That's almost double the amount from 2020. Online ordering is the biggest driver, and Robertson says the rising price of shipping has made returns too expensive for retailers.
Some have been successful with hiding that in price increases. But it comes a time where you can just raise the price of an item just so much before you can't do it anymore.
That time is now, because inflation is also forcing retailers to raise prices. Return fees also help discourage return fraud and what the industry calls wardrobing. Mehmet Altug is a professor of operations management at George Mason University.
Majority of the returns are just regular good customers, but then there are these purchasers that buy something knowing that they're going to return.
Altug thinks more companies will start charging return fees. But will buyers balk? Marshall Cohen is a retail analyst with NPD Group.
One of the top three reasons why consumers choose the site when they buy online is the ease of returns.
So companies have to walk a fine line, make money on return fees, or risk customers walking away. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Super quick last inflation question here because we're a little jammed on time. This one is from Detroit.
Antoine Heath, my question is, what's the gas price inflation about? Last Sunday, it was at $4.99. I woke up in the morning, it was at $5.26. That's a 27-cent change overnight. I need to know. That's my question.
So, yeah, that's a good question, right? Crude oil prices, whence one gets gas, of course, are up because global supply is down. And it's a very tight market to begin with, the global oil market. That's one thing. Also, specifically in this country, one word, people, refineries. Andy Euler has been reporting on this for us a lot. We don't have the refining capacity we need to turn all the oil we have into the gas we want to use. Today in cryptocurrency vocabulary, you probably do want to be aware of stablecoin. Cryptocurrencies that are set up to always be worth one U.S. dollar, and they are used in very basic terms to let crypto traders move money into and out of other cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin is the best known one probably. We're doing this vocabulary lesson because a couple of weeks ago, one stablecoin known as Terra USD lost that peg to the dollar. It crashed, in fact, leaving all kinds of chaos and lost real-world actual money in its wake. Today, Bloomberg reports the SEC is looking into Terra USD, specifically whether its backers broke the rules designed to protect investors. Those investors included venture capitalists and crypto hedge funds that took big, big hits, but also bartenders and contractors and veterans who lost their savings. And as Marketplace's Matt Levin reports, before the crash, a whole lot of those people didn't know what Terra was or that they even owned any.
Steve Insall spent the afternoon of Tuesday, May 10th, watching an app on his phone as his life savings, $320,000, dwindled by the second. He tried to keep his wife from noticing his panic.
She was getting ready for work. I think the two little ones, the baby was eating on the high chair. The three-year-old was on the iPad. I was keeping it all inside.
Insall and his wife are both bartenders. Most of that $320,000 was an inheritance from Insall's father.
We always had plans of getting a nice, you know, nice size house for our family, and that would help with the down payment.
Insall ended up losing most of that money in the Terra USD crash when the algorithmic stablecoin lost nearly all its value. If you're wondering why anyone would put all their money into something called an algorithmic stablecoin, Insall wonders that too. He didn't know that's what he was doing.
And I was just searching around. I came across StableGain's site. And, you know, they advertised as a savings account.
StableGains is a Delaware incorporated startup that launched last August. It marketed a crypto version of a traditional savings account. Except where Citibank was offering you less than 1% interest, StableGains could offer you up to 15%. The pitch was aimed at retail investors, some of whom were very tech savvy and others, well,
I don't Snapchat, I don't TikTok, I don't whatever those other things are.
Jason Neutzel is a general contractor in Kansas. He also poured his life savings, $16,000, into StableGains.
I am pretty sure that I saw them on Facebook. Like, I was Googling like Roth IRAs, mutual funds. So, of course, once you Google and Facebook have to be in cahoots with each other because all of a sudden you start seeing investment things, advertisements on Facebook.
Neutzel did some research. He thought the co-founders looked reputable. StableGains was also backed by Y Combinator, the same venture capital accelerator that launched Dropbox and Airbnb. StableGains was not FDIC insured, but Neutzel believed it was way less risky than your typical crypto investment.
You know, I said that they were, you know, diversified, and they said that all the investments were backed up with collateral.
Think of how a bank works. You deposit your cash, the bank lends it out as mortgages and business loans. The banks get interest from those borrowers, and you get a cut of that interest. It's an oversimplification, but the same basic principles applied to StableGains. It would invest deposits in crypto lending platforms. Instead of homeowners borrowing mortgages, it was other crypto investors borrowing crypto to invest in more crypto. Welcome to the world of decentralized finance, or DeFi for short.
What is being promoted by individuals involved within DeFi is that not only is this like legacy finance, but it's actually better.
Ryan Clements is a law professor at the University of Calgary and a DeFi skeptic.
Because we're disintermediating banks, we're disintermediating investment managers. And, oh, by the way, it provides significantly higher returns.
Many StableGains investors like Jason Neutzel thought they were spreading risk across different types of crypto. But if you waded through the terms of use, diversification is what StableGains was planning to do in the future. At the time, they were taking all deposits and investing it in one lending system tied to one cryptocurrency. It's like a bank lending all its money to one housing developer building one neighborhood. That neighborhood was Terra USD.
Retail investors were coming into this and they were thinking they were getting a product and a service that was the same as something they would get in traditional finance.
Again, law professor Ryan Clements.
But they weren't. They weren't getting the same regulatory safeguards. I think there just needs to be clear disclosure, but also accessible disclosure.
StableGains is no longer accepting deposits and is discontinuing operations. The company declined a request for an interview, but referred to this public statement.
Of course, as all users know, the DeFi space does present risks, which are publicly known and additionally disclosed in our terms of use, online in our learning center, website footer, and blog.
Some brick-and-mortar banks are allowing their customers to reverse recent deposits into stable gains. Jason Neutzel, the Kansas contractor, says that's probably going to allow him to get back most of what he lost. He says he's not ruling out investing some of it in crypto again. Some of it. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a ticker symbol update. FB is dead. Long live Meta. The Facebook to Meta name change was announced back in October. The ticker symbol swap became effective today. And how, you ask, are Meta shares doing? Oh, down almost 40% since the name change. Huh. Okay, off we go. Here is your moment of economic context. Before we say goodbye, though, via the Internal Revenue Service, this one is, and also relevant to those of you for whom mileage is a business expense. The IRS announced today that effective July 1, the standard mileage rate for business travel is going to be 62.5 cents a mile. That's a 4-cent bump. Acknowledging the rise in gas prices, the IRS was, and yes, I know gas is up more than whatever that percentage is of 4 cents on a 58-cent base. Don't look at me. I don't make the rules. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Peacher, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.